on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, the show that reminds you each week that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women, who have done pretty remarkable things for the sake of our freedom. And if you're a regular listener, you know that most of the time it is a man who I'm interviewing. 98% of World War II veterans are male. But today we're taking a ladies' look as we examine the role of women in World War II. Many women were part of the war effort without actually serving in the military, from all those Rosie the Riveter types famously toiling away in aircraft factories to the homemakers across the country who simply made selfless choices because of the gravity of the time they knew they were living in. Some of you may know that what got me started interviewing veterans many years ago was a desire to record my grandfather's story of service in the Army Medical Corps in Europe, where he earned the Silver Star and the Bronze Star. And while my grandmother was waiting for him to come home so they could get married, she was doing her part as a filing clerk working under a captain with the Army Corps of Engineers, keeping track of all their heavy equipment that was being shipped out of the port of Seattle. I'm kind of hoping she dozed off during the commercial break so she won't be too mad at me for sharing that nugget with you. The one unanimous refrain I've heard from every veteran I've interviewed over the years is how united our United States truly were during World War II, and the service of the Marine Corps Women's Reserve is another example of that. Ladies who responded to the recruiting pitch of "Be a Marine, free a Marine to fight." You can find those posters from the period on our Hometown Heroes Facebook page, too. Our guest today, 90-year-old June Moran, answered that call. Originally from Pennsylvania, she lives in Fresno County now in Kingsburg, famous, of course, for its Swedish village. But she had been living in San Diego when she signed up for the Marines. And I have to imagine, June, from San Diego, it's hard to get sent anywhere because everybody wants to live in San Diego. It's the best place to live. Did you have an idea of where you were hoping the Marine Corps would send you?
Well, I was hoping they'd send me back to California, but that didn't happen. I stayed in North Carolina the whole time, 2 years that I was in. I stayed there. A lot of the gals got back to California. We had quite a group from California. And my buddy that I went to boot camp with was from Inglewood, California, and she got sent back to Santa Barbara. Lucky girl. But she was in a photo lab. They put her in the photo lab there.
So you were in Camp Lejeune, and how many women did you have there?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember. We had two barracks full of women, and so each platoon is like 29, 30 in a platoon. And so the squad room, we were topside, so we had two platoons there. And a lot of, I can't tell you the number, really.
But you were far outnumbered by the men.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And we had a nice rec room, what they call a rec hall, where they was really nice dance floor, and that's what we did a lot. And, of course, they did serve beer, something like a 2.5-week beer. But because the fellas always thought, oh, your beer is better than ours, and it's colder. So they would stand outside of the rec hall waiting for somebody to come along and because they couldn't come in unless they were accompanied by a WR. So they would wait and, you know, do everything they could to get you to say, oh, come on in with us, you know. They were something else, just dying to get in there.
Well, and if that's the case, I imagine you had the pick of the litter then.
Pretty much. It was a pretty good deal, actually. That was the fun part, really. You could dance every night in the rec hall, and most of us did.
What were your day-to-day responsibilities? What kinds of things did they have you doing?
Well, first thing you make that, what they call your sack or your bed, was a cot, and you had best make it to standard. And always leave your area neat and clean, and your uniforms and everything had to be, you know, facing one way, everything in the same direction. Nothing laying around, nothing on your bunk, nothing on the floor, everything put away. Footlocker inspection was whenever they decided they wanted to do it. And if your footlocker wasn't as neat as they liked it, they dumped it on the floor, and that meant you had to redo it until they were happy with it.
Well, your daughter's here. I'm just curious if your childhood was something like what she's describing now and cleaning your bedroom. No, not that bad, huh? Okay. Did you find fulfillment in this work? How did you feel about what you were doing? Did you feel like it was important, that it was making a difference? Or what was your mindset about it at the time?
Well, the fellow that I replaced was so happy to see me. He was from New Jersey, I think. And he said, "Sweetheart, am I glad to see you?" And he grabs me and twirls me around in the office where I'm supposed to be, and then punks me down, grabbed his hat, he was out the door. He was so happy to be relieved to get to, well, actually to go out and get killed. But they just could hardly stand not to be in the action, the fellas. They really, really wanted to do it. And we had a sergeant major, an old salt that had at least probably 30 years in. But he was pretty nice about it. There were a lot that didn't feel the women should be in at all. I mean, what are you doing to my Marine Corps letting women in here? He was pretty neat with it. And the guys were really happy to see us come in and take over their job so they could get the heck out of there.
Well, and what kind of impression did that leave you with about the men that were overseas fighting this war when you saw their reactions in situations like that?
I know I give them an awful lot of credit for wanting to go out and risk being killed, because the Marines really got the dirty part of the war. I think the Guadalcanal, the 1st Division, was just terrible. Iwo Jima, Saipan, those places, they threw them in there with... I mean, it was terrible, terrible, just terrible. They lost so many men. And yet they were eager to go. They wanted to go and defend our country. They were all for it.
What do you think made it that way, made so many people feel that strongly about what they were fighting for, that they'd be willing to die?
I don't know that answer. I really don't know that answer. But to preserve what our way of life had been in those days, I'm sure, and their own families, thinking of, you know, keeping them away from our shores. But who knew what was going to happen? I mean, we never thought that Pearl Harbor would happen to us. So from then on, you really didn't. I mean, you're on the coast, on the West Coast or the East Coast there. You're more vulnerable than in Midwest, I think.
Well, and you mentioned some of the big battles that the Marine Corps was involved in the Pacific, Guadalcanal. There was Tarawa, which was very bloody, and Iwo Jima, as you said. There at Camp Lejeune, did you guys find out about that? Were you seeing reports or reading the newspaper? And how did that play out at Camp Lejeune, where all these other people are training to go take their place?
Well, the ones that were returned came back to Camp Lejeune, so... Once in a while, you could get them to tell you a little bit about it, but most of them were very quiet about it. But you knew from looking at them, they had been through hell and back. They didn't want to talk about it, really. They were there to be rehabilitated, I'm sure. I don't know if they gave them a different, they gave them stateside duty after being over there, especially. You were there for at least a year or more, I'm sure, before they bring them back. And sort of rotate them, but then they gave them, they had the LSDs that landed the fellas, or all the either Marines or the Army. They decided that this would be a good thing to show the public how it worked, and they used the Mississippi, so they would go to certain towns that were right on the Mississippi and show them how they would land men on shore. And they did those as demonstrations, and I think they gave that job to those that returned from being in horrible situations.
And you mentioned the guy whose place you took in the office and how excited he was to get out of there. But tell us what you were doing in that office, because I'm sure some people, some young ladies might want to know, well, what was a female Marine doing in that office in World War II? What was the big important job you had?
Big important job was that you knew all the fellows that were... the divisions that were being shipped out, and you knew who was coming in. And it was called a strip file, and they typed out all the names and on a strip like this, and you inserted it in a file that was in front of you. You just kept doing that all day for a while. And you did typing and orders, and but you knew the troop movement. You knew what was going on in that office.
And was that just a job to you, or were there times where that became personal, where you knew something about someone's name that was on there, or just the magnitude of how many names were there struck you in a certain way?
It was the tremendous amount of men that you processed each day, or you knew. And you were also not to tell what was going on in that. You know, if this was unit was going out, you were not to say anything about it, which most of us kept to ourselves, really. I didn't know anyone that was, that as I was pulling those records, but just the amount of personnel that they moved every day was tremendous. I mean, that was a huge base.
One of the other things that I've learned about that base at Camp Lejeune, there was a group from the middle to the end of the war of black Marines there, the Munford Point Marines. And I've had a chance to interview a couple of those guys and get their story of how they were treated and what their ordeal was. Did you ever see or hear of their presence around there?
Oh, yeah. We knew where they were. They were Munford Point, and they were segregated off to another section. But they had a great band. And so they were invited to play for dances, especially if it was an extra special sort of thing. To play for, and they were really good. They were good, but they were segregated. They were on their own at Mofford Point, exactly where they were. Yeah, good sized division of them too.
Mm-hmm. Did that ever, and you're in the South in North Carolina, did that ever occur to you that maybe things shouldn't be that way, or did it seem strange to you, or that's just the way it was at the time in that part of the country?
It's the way it was in that part of the country, and you best just go with it. Really, I mean, there wasn't any wondering why. That's the way it was, period. And if you took a bus, which we did now and then, went to Wilmington, if you had got on the bus, there was this happened to be a yellow line. They call it a white line, where the back is reserved for the blacks and the front is for the whites. And so we got on the bus one time to go into Wilmington, and all the front of the bus is filled. And here's this yellow line, which didn't mean anything to me, really. So, of course, I crossed it and went in the back and sat down. And the fellow I was with just picked me up by the elbow and said, "I think we need to be up here in the front." I didn't get it until we got off of the bus, and then when I noticed, oh, okay. That was new to me, really new to me, because in the West, I mean, we were out in California, that didn't happen, but it certainly happened there, yeah.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth or take you somewhere that you didn't experience, but when you think back on that now and remembering those dances where that band is playing, or knowing that these guys are wearing the same uniform, then seeing the history that's unfolded since then, do you feel like those gentlemen, by doing what they did at that time, kind of paved the way for what followed with the civil rights movement?
I think it was a big movement there for that. Yeah, I do. They seem to be comfortable with it, but there's always the few that aren't. But that certainly was a start for them, I'm sure. Yeah.
And what about you? If you spent 2 years there, I'm sure not every day was just sunshine and roses. There must have been a few days along the way where you faced some challenges, or maybe someone didn't treat you the way they should have. Were you ever treated differently because you're a woman?
Not really, no. The guys were really nice to us. There was always a few that, man, as they say, the old ones really didn't think we should be in there, but I don't think we were ever really mistreated. No, they were pretty nice guys that were happy to see us there to, you know, let them go and get out of there. Mode they were in and get off to bigger and better things.
Well, I'm sure they're happy to see you because you're a lot better looking than the guys they were spending all their time with too. And that hasn't changed. If you don't believe me, just hop on Facebook and punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. You'll find photos of June in her Marine Corps uniform as well as what she looks like today. Striking a slightly different tone on Hometown Heroes this time as we hear about life in the Marine Corps Women's Reserve with 90-year-old June Moran. We're not done yet. The rest of the program and a brief look ahead to next week's interview when Hometown Heroes continues right after this.
The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490.